across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlove.
Well, hey there, Wisconsin. Good morning. Welcome to the State of Wisconsin Sense here on the shores of Lake Wissota, where it's a beautiful day up north. It's Wednesday, June 21st, 59 degrees up here on the lake, here on our home base, 93.5 The Tap. In Palmyra, it's 55 this morning. Tomahawk coming in at 46. New Lisbon reporting 54. Well, here's what's on tap this morning. One of the things we've done somewhat frequently on the program is outline the necessity of clean water and let people know of the various threats that exist to it. And there's no shortage of them. Sure, we've talked about PFAS, you know, those industrial chemicals, but there's high capacity wells and farm runoff. There's industrial runoff. And we can't forget there's demographics as baby boomers retire, and there's small government ideologues who are cutting into local government budgets and making it harder to find the people who are replacing retiring baby boomers in watching over our water supply. We're going to talk to Melissa Baldoff about that in our weekly climate check. It's been a rough week for Wisconsin students. First off, you had Governor Tony Evers signing off on a deal yesterday that while it increases funds to public schools, it also continues to undermine public education by increasing funds to voucher schools. Then you've also got the UW system facing a Republican budget cut despite a $7 billion surplus. And then Republican lawmakers tried to sneak through a change that threatens technical college budgets. And we have figured out who it is that authored that plan. It won't be a big surprise, but some folks still had to do some digging around to find out who it was. And these same legislators are trying to kill an affordable child care program. So at 7:30, we'll talk to a couple of child care providers about that and efforts to get that essential child care support program back into the state budget. So those child care providers at 7:30, Representative Jody Emerson will join us at 7:05. Along the way, if you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, the studio line number is 844-967-2789, and her email address is radio@upnorthnewswi.com. And if you're catching this as a live video feed on Facebook, on the Up North News page, put your comment below there, and we might show it to you here. Aaron Zommers joins us now on this first day of summer. Summer arriving, in just under 4 hours at 9:57 this morning. Aaron, good morning.
Good morning. I look forward to attempting to sleep tonight on the longest day of the year.
It is unusual for those of us who are still relatively new in returning to morning radio, in my part, to be going to bed when the sun is still a little bit above the horizon. And you and I both are starting to appreciate the value of blackout curtains or, you know, better blinds.
Oh, yeah. I'm moving at the end of the month. And once I'm there, I'm definitely going to invest.
I think that would probably be a good idea. Even though this little phase only lasts for a couple of months, you know, still, who wouldn't like that, right?
Yeah, being able to sleep is typically appreciated.
Big fan of that. Let's see. There's so much that we're going to be able to try to talk about today. We're not going to get it all in. So some of them might just get a mention. For example, Aaron Rodgers is going to be the headline speaker at a conference on psychedelics.
Oh, how the mighty have fallen.
I don't even know where else to go with that, except say it's, you know, keeping in character, I guess. So the note from the Associated Press says, months after Colorado's voters decided to join Oregon in decriminalizing psychedelic mushrooms, Denver will host a conference this week put on by a psychedelic advocacy group, bringing together an unlikely cohort of speakers, a former Republican governor, a rapper, and NFL star quarterback Aaron Rodgers. So he's either a pioneer in the use of psychedelics or just continuing to be an outlier, and people will look back and go, what happened to that guy? And I guess we could say the psychedelics.
I was going to say, a role. I think we know exactly what happened to him.
Well, so we've got that going for us. We are going to touch not only on the governor signing that two-part deal for revenue sharing and school funding. There's also a new story out about infighting on the Wisconsin Supreme Court amongst the conservatives. There's a brand new story out about the U.S. Supreme Court and the continued corruption we're discovering by right-wing justices who are accepting luxury travel and then not reporting those gifts. There's the former Trump attorney who helped design, the legal strategy to overturn the 2020 election, who has some Wisconsin ties. He's now in court for potentially being disbarred and losing his law license. There's Hunter Biden making a plea deal for crimes that most regular folks would not even be charged with, but because Republicans are asking basically for the death penalty, on the other hand, this is apparently the middle ground. So we have all manner of topics to get to yet today. And before I forget, when we talk about the John Eastman one, the Trump attorney, I'm going to make special note that this comes on this 1 year anniversary of discovering the role that Ron Johnson very nearly could have played in the insurrection on January 6th. If Vice President Mike Pence had wanted to go along with Trump's plan for a coup, there were fraudulent ballots sitting in Ron Johnson's office, and he quite possibly could have been minutes away from becoming the mule that he and others said happens on Election Day 2020, when he may have been the one all poised to be a mule instead. So much to cover, so stick around for this Wednesday morning. You're Up North. We'll be back. This is Brandon Flowers, lead singer of The Killers. He has a birthday today, turns 42 years old. We have some more celebrity and musical birthdays and historical notes coming up about 6:50, a little later on this hour. Time for sports, a quarter past six. The Milwaukee Brewers went more than a month without rallying to win any games that they had trailed by multiple runs. Now they've done it twice in the past 3 days. William Contreras hit a two-run double in the seventh inning, put Milwaukee ahead for good. The Brewers came back from a four-run deficit to beat the Arizona Diamondbacks last night, 7-5. It was the biggest comeback the Brewers had produced in any of the wins this season. It came two nights after erasing a 2-0 deficit to beat the Pirates, 5-2. That's the first time since May 14th that they'd won a game where they'd trailed by more than one run. The Diamondbacks and Brewers will do it one more time this afternoon at American Family Field. Then the Brewers are off on a long road trip starting this coming weekend in Cleveland. You can hear the games in the Fox Valley on Oshkosh Air Support, 98.3, 1100 AM, and News from the Center, 107.7 FM, 1450 AM. Also on Up North News, on our Facebook page right now, not only can you see a live video feed of this fine radio program, but we have started a new series. It's almost like word association, Aaron. This is the, I mentioned this last week. One of the posts we put up was Wisconsin's best brewery is blank, and then people filled in all kinds of things. And I see that what Sharita Booker put up yesterday, the single best food at the Wisconsin State Fair is blank. I almost feel like we're playing match game. I need Gene Rayburn's really skinny microphone, to do this. So best state fair food, go.
I think I'm going to have to go with the tried and true classic, beer battered cheese curds.
Oh, see, now you said the tried and true classic, and you know how many people said cream puffs?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Everybody talks about the cream puffs.
Having never been to the state fair, I just haven't had a lot of cream puffs. I haven't been as big on sweets as on savory foods, personally.
Now, coincidentally, I'm going to mention an article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the Wisconsin Supreme Court written by reporter Jesse O'Point. Jesse opened up basically kicked a hornet's nest. Was it about two, three years ago when she said something about not really liking the state fair cream puffs, that they're a bit overrated and I mean, you may as well have said, that you're lactose intolerant in the dairy state, for all the blowback that she got. I have to say, the couple of times I've been to the state fair, I mean, the cream puffs are okay, but you know, other people swear by them, say they're heaven sent. But yeah, if you were going to say I could only have the cream puffs or the cheese curds, I'd probably go with the cheese curds.
I know that's where I'd go.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm getting at on the post here, and just search for Up North News WI on the post and fill in your answer below. Dozens of comments, cream puffs, corn on the cob, the hand-cut French fries, the many different flavors of milk. Let's see, we got funnel cake. There's the baked potatoes in the ag building, fried olives, maple cotton candy. That's a new one on me. Pork chop sandwich. And this one, pizza in parentheses, Chicago style, which again is another hornet's nest that you open up as far as who's got the best pizza. But apparently there must be a Chicago style pizza place at the state fair.
There must be. You know, another thing that's always good at fairs is those like donut machines. You just watch them roll out those little donuts. Those are always tasty.
I love the mini donuts so much. That's right. And where did we have those? Oh, out of a food truck at the Liney Lodge over the weekend. And they came in an 8-pack of 8 different flavors. Ooh. Like lemon frosting and Butterfinger. And like red velvet, I think, was one of them. It was great. Really not going to try to lose any weight this summer, are we? Not
when they make it so hard with 8 different flavored donuts. I mean, you got to try them all.
Oh, of course. Here's what I did. I got the diet version of it, meaning that I split it with Sherry. So she had half of each of the 8, and I had the other half of each of the 8. So, I mean, that's 50% of the calories right there. I should be losing weight on that deal, right?
You'd think.
You'd think, but, my wife being a doctor, she says that's not how science works. So I guess I'll defer to her. In the headlines, Governor Evers was in Wausau yesterday and did sign that 2-part deal that provides a major restructuring on how state funding is sent to how it is sent to cities, counties, towns, villages, public schools, private schools. The signing ceremony was held at a fire station in Wausau, and Evers said that the bipartisan revenue sharing deal for local governments provides a historic increase in support, quote, to ensure our communities have the resources they need to meet basic and unique needs alike. But then there's the other half of it, which was the increase in school funding. And Governor Evers was understandably happy to have been able to strike a deal with Republicans that provided a hefty increase in public school funding. But there was also quite a big increase that went to voucher schools, private and religious schools, and public education advocates were not happy about that at all. They described the package as, quote, the most reckless and irresponsible thing Wisconsin could do with its massive surplus. They say the increased funding is more than offset by the expansion of funding for vouchers that those schools drain state and local resources from neighborhood public schools. But the deal is done, and as we mentioned before, with politics, you know, being the art of the possible, it is noteworthy that Evers and Republicans were able to do this much, and those who want to fight on have a couple of different options. I've mentioned previously that Kirk Bangstad's Minocqua Brewing Company Super PAC is looking into filing a lawsuit once the state Supreme Court changes into progressive control and potentially get the voucher system, you know, ruled unconstitutional because of the way it undermines what is constitutionally called for, and that is a public education or an education as uniform as practicable across the state. There's then also the ballot box. If you can get rid of gerrymandering, again, probably through the state Supreme Court, you could conceivably finally get a legislature that is more representative of the general public, and maybe in that way provide much better support to Wisconsin's long tradition of public education. So let's keep in mind that when it comes to education in Wisconsin, it's been a rough couple of weeks. You got public schools getting more funding, but voucher schools getting a truckload of your tax dollars. You've got Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who couldn't give a rip about a $7 billion surplus when it comes to the University of Wisconsin system. He's been pushing to actually cut funding because the UW system has the audacity to stand against racial injustice. We also know that Voss and the Republicans are against actual Wisconsin-grown jobs because of the way they rejected expanding the College of Engineering. Not to mention their middle-of-the-night vote to kill the Child Care Counts program. That'll result in local jobs being lost and local workers having to leave the workforce when their daycare options dwindle even further. So we wondered, is there any part of Wisconsin education and workforce improvement that Robin Voss and other Republicans in the legislature haven't come after with the wrecking ball? And then they did, the Wisconsin Technical College system. As we learned back on Monday, Republicans are coming for the tech colleges next. And they tried to do it without the guts to notify you, the public, and let you have a chance to hear the details and speak out about it, either for or against, but instead slipping it into a bill without any hearing, a bill that had already existed. The bill that previously existed was essentially superseded by this two-part deal that I just described about school funding with Governor Evers and the Republicans. And so in a committee last week, the Assembly Ways and Means Committee, State Representative John Mako introduced an amendment that basically replaced the entire bill with language that would remove the ability of the technical colleges to levy taxes to pay for operations and maintenance. So instead of levying for operations and maintenance, which has been done for like a century in the state, that would be replaced by state aid from the legislature. Well, what does that mean? It means that the technical college system suddenly is at the whims of partisan politicians the same way that the UW system is. The Wisconsin Policy Forum, a nonpartisan think tank, did an analysis in April. It found that technical colleges in Wisconsin had the fifth highest funding in the nation compared to other states, based on not just the state aid that's already there, but on votes made at the local government, local voter level to support their technical colleges and the job creation that results. By comparison, the University of Wisconsin system, which can't get a dime unless it says Mother May I from the legislature, UW system funding is ranked eighth worst in the nation. So how did this come to be that this major change to funding the Wisconsin Technical College system could be snuck into a bill that would pass through committee without any kind of a public hearing, without anybody really knowing and being able to testify about it? Well, Wisconsin Public Radio did a little look into the proposal, and while Representative Mako was listed as the author of the proposal, Wisconsin Public Radio was able to find the drafting files that were requested, and it was Assembly Speaker Robin Voss who requested the amendment to that bill with the instruction to increase property tax relief aid to technical colleges, but then eliminate the operating levy for technical colleges beginning with the 2023-2024 school year. It was Robin Voss who's already attacked the UW system, has already undermined public education with huge growth in voucher schools, who is now trying to put the Wisconsin Technical College system in the same politically precarious position that the University of Wisconsin system is in. I mentioned Jesse O'Poin earlier and her article in the Journal Sentinel about the state Supreme Court. And what the article was based on is infighting between the conservative justices about a 2020 case when some parents sued the Madison School District over a policy that allows students to self-identify their names and pronouns without involving their parents. Three of the court's right-wing justices wanted to fast-track it, basically steal it away from the Court of Appeals and take it up for themselves. That's certainly what the court's most vocal right-wing politician, Rebecca Bradley, wanted to do. So she was more than a little miffed that fellow conservative Brian Hagedorn refused to go along, not because of any change in his conservative values, but that he felt as a justice that he agreed with the lower court that the plaintiff in this case didn't have standing to bring the case. Rebecca Bradley wanted to take it anyway and talked all about the culture wars and the biased media and all those things that essentially are making a mockery of our state Supreme Court when they use politics to continue judicial battles against racial fairness and personal respect in something like the use of pronouns. All right, it's time for our weekly climate check with Melissa Baldoff. That's coming up in just a bit. You're up north. It's electric. It's time now for this week's climate check. Melissa Baldoff joins us. And this time around, when we talk about the climate, a bit more of an environmental accent that we'll have today, especially when it comes to clean water in the ground and clean water that comes out of your tap. And in both cases, that these things don't just happen. They take a little bit of work. And Melissa's going to tell us more about that. Melissa, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's talk first about PFAS, P-F-A-S. That's an acronym for a very long chemical name. Just think of it as industrial chemicals, I guess, over the decades that have seeped into the groundwater for all sorts of reasons. And because we're talking many different chemicals, many different sources and so forth, it's not easy to address, but I think some people are concerned that the Wisconsin legislature has made it a little tougher to address. I mean, on the one hand, they've introduced a bill. But on the other hand, does the bill really do everything that could be done right now? And so that's where we all want to focus on that. So, Melissa, as you're looking through legislation that's working its way through the state capitol right now, what's your overview of it?
It's one of those things, we've talked about this before, Pat, that, you know, we really just need people to step up and do the right thing. And it's no different when it comes to this issue. Like you mentioned, lots of different kinds of chemicals in the water affecting different parts of the state in different ways. But the commonality is that everyone needs help from the state to be able to really address this issue. And, you know, it's good that we finally are seeing some more Republicans willing to come to the table for a bipartisan solution on this, because this is an issue that is affecting everybody. But it is disappointing that they're kind of stopping short of really doing what's going to be needed to address this issue in a meaningful way. Right now, as the bill is drafted, you know, there are really some restrictions on DNR's ability to actually protect people from contamination. It limits their authority to test, particularly when it would allow the DNR to actually take actions against the responsible parties, because, you know, we know that if polluters aren't held accountable, they're unlikely to change their ways. They're less likely to change their ways. So we really need DNR to have the ability to have some teeth with the enforcement to prevent future contamination. Definitely also, you know, would want to see a broadening of the definition of PFAS to make sure that, you know, we're not limiting the definition here, and that there's going to be more things that are identified, you know, as research continues, more hazards are identified, more communities might be finding contamination, more people are learning about the dangers associated with different chemicals. We want to make sure there's a broad enough definition to where we're not having to come back over and over again to say, well, you know, yeah, this is pollution, but what kind and how bad and are we going to address it? So, you know, that's something also that I think a lot of people would like to see, a broadening of the definition. And also, you know, to really just provide some more resources to local governments as they are working to mitigate these really harmful impacts. So, you know, making it to where it's not a hardship on communities and on the people who are trying to address these issues, you know, on their land.
There's something you said there that is awfully reminiscent, harkens back to points that I was making yesterday about the state budget overall, and that for Republicans, everything seems to be about cutting taxes. If you cut taxes, you know, that solves whatever the problem might be, when actually you need things that are much more, you know, policy prescriptive. And in this case, what you have is a bill that does provide some more grants to municipalities for testing and to pay for some infrastructure upgrades. But again, you can't just, you know, it's not a matter of just throwing money at something through tax cuts or through grants. If you have to have the power of enforcement, if you don't have, in this case, a Department of Natural Resources that is helping identify and crack down on this kind of thing. I mean, you can give grants all day long, but there's nothing really preventative about that, is there?
No, there's not. And that's why the enforcement piece is so important, you know, to make sure that we are preventing future contamination from happening. And, you know, there is broad support around the state for protections for our water. You know, that is what, and, you know, polling I've seen and focus groups, conversations I've seen with voters over the years, clean water is just about one of the most popular topics that you hear about from people. Everybody cares about it. You know, nobody wants gallons of raw sewage flowing into our lakes and our rivers. Everybody wants to clean up our waters, to clean up our lands. And, you know, if we're not serious about holding the people who are polluting accountable, we're going to just continue to find these problems. You know, they're going to continue and they're going to get worse in a lot of cases.
Well, not everybody, you know, feels that way. There's this group, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. I know you're familiar with them. It's this business advocacy group. And I note this, I want to give proper credit to Hope Kerwin from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm pulling this little blip from that story that says, when it comes to WMC, they are calling for cutting the 6 PFAS chemicals identified in the bill down to 2. And they support a requirement in the bill that the DNR has to get written permission from a landowner before doing water testing, and has called for expanding that requirement to whether the agency can publicly share the results of any tests. In other words, WMC is working so hard to keep something quiet. Like, we don't want you to know what might be happening on your neighbor's land that might affect your water. It's a very closed loop process that we have here that isn't nearly as transparent as we would hope the water would ultimately be.
Right. And I think that's something we've seen from these folks over and over again, you know, that they claim that they are, you know, fighting for our businesses and our economy, but having contaminated water is very harmful to our businesses and our local economies. So many folks are in industries around the state that rely on clean water, clean air, having a healthy environment. And by allowing these large corporations to pollute our water, it's really damaging the local economies and impacting the ability of smaller businesses and smaller farmers to be able to do their jobs well and keep their communities healthy and grow their bottom line. So, you know, I think we've seen just time and again from WMC that, you know, they are looking out for the bottom line of the very largest businesses and industries and trying to protect the profits for that, you know, that top percent of earners, and really leaving the rest of the folks in this state behind and leaving them with, you know, fewer protections, fewer opportunities to be able to, you know, clean up their own issues too.
Melissa Baldoff is here with us for this week's Climate Check. We are talking about clean Wisconsin water. It's not always as easy as it sounds, and some folks are kind of getting in the way of that. And it's not just industrial chemicals and farm runoff and high capacity wells and you know, a changing climate itself that can make it more of a challenge to keep our water clean. There's also demographics, and there's what I would call small government ideologues, the people that want to keep all government budgets as small as possible. That's tough to do when you're trying to attract people to replace, say, baby boomers that are retiring. And the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, through their USA Today network, had an interesting story starting in Luck, Wisconsin, about the challenge of smaller communities finding the people who are going to oversee the water infrastructure and ensure that our communities have clean water over the years. And, you know, again, I use this example all the time, Melissa, that, you know, clean water coming out of your tap and your sewage being treated, those things don't happen by themselves. They take tax dollars and they take, you know, leadership and resources and positions for people to do it. And I hope this article serves as a wake-up call for folks about the importance of this issue.
I agree. It is definitely something that really is a challenge for smaller communities and smaller governments. You know, these are expensive systems to operate, to update, to maintain. And you also have folks who are, you know, continuing to do more with less in terms of staff. You know, it is difficult to attract and retain qualified staff to work in some of these public service jobs. And, you know, I think part of it too, a big part is we can't ignore what happened, you know, in 2011 and the way that public workers were devalued and attacked under the previous administration. And the way that, you know, by continued disinvestment in local government, you know, we've seen the ability of local governments to pay their employees well and be competitive has really waned, you know, and you see a lot of folks who, you know, have a commitment to public service. They want to work and serve in their community, but they've got a family to support too. And, you know, they're doing these jobs that are incredibly difficult and incredibly important jobs, you know, not keeping their wages, you know, on pace with inflation. And if they have an opportunity in the private sector to pay more with better working conditions, it can be really difficult to say no to that. So I do think this was a really important spotlight on the challenges that our local governments are facing in terms of administering these, you know, these complicated systems that are incredibly important, and, you know, having the staff needed to run them.
And makes clear that what's been done is way overdue, but still not nearly enough. The article notes that the American Rescue Plan Act and the bipartisan infrastructure law will put billions of dollars into water infrastructure. But even then, at least one nationwide report estimates that the U.S. would need to invest about $3.3 trillion in water and wastewater infrastructure projects between now and 2039 to keep systems updated. And I guess, Melissa, what I'm trying to say is for policymakers who are listening to this and who say, oh, there's just been so much government spending between the American Rescue Plan and the infrastructure law. Actually, no, there's so much more needed because of so many years of budget austerity from people who think these clean water systems magically happen.
Right. You know, it's the budget austerity and it's the science deniers, too. You know, I think we've had here in Wisconsin previously an approach of let's just stick our head in the sand when it comes to cleaning up our environment. And they wanted to believe that nothing was going wrong. Everything was just fine. And in some cases, really just absolutely denying the science behind what's been happening. So it is so refreshing that we have a governor who has put science back in the DNR and has been a strong partner to local governments as they are trying to mitigate some of these issues. But it really is going to take a lot of people stepping up to do the right thing and make these investments. Like you said, it's a staggering number what is required to make the improvements needed to ensure we have a healthy water supply.
And whatever comes from the federal budget or state budgets, local communities are still going to have to rely by and large on the local tax base. And that means water rates in some communities are just going to continue to grow, even as they don't necessarily have, you know, the population and income base to support those higher water rates. And Melissa, we don't even have time to get into the stress on the water infrastructure as places out west fill up. But if this has helped, this segment has helped people just be more cognizant of water and to be more supportive of the policymakers who make that a priority, then perhaps we've done some good here.
Exactly. And like you said, you know, for folks, and I it is my greatest hope that everyone who's listening, everyone out there, when they turn their tap on to fill up their glass of water, like I'm going to go do when we're done here, that it is clean and clear and they're going to be able to drink it and feel good about it. And they could send their kids in from outside or have their kids drink from the hose like we all did. But, you know, that doesn't happen by itself. There's a lot of work that goes into having clean water. And I hope, like you said, that there will be an appreciation for what goes into it and some commitments at the federal level and at the state level, too, to continue investing.
This week's Climate Check comes from Melissa Paldoff. Melissa, thanks very much. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too.
Still ahead, we're going to talk to State Representative Jody Emerson about some of the shenanigans, shall we say, that Republicans have been playing with some of these bills. But first, today's history lesson and music break. That's right after this. You're up north. Here we go, back to 1975, the number one song this day from the Captain and Tennille, and it would stay at the number one spot for 4 weeks. We already mentioned the birthday today. Brandon Flowers, lead singer of The Killers, turns 42. Lana Del Rey is 38 years old today. She was born Elizabeth Grant. Also, a happy 79th birthday to Ray Davies from The Kinks. There's a couple of interesting birthdays here, especially if you remember 70s and 80s TV. You've got Bernie Capel. Doc from The Love Boat turns 90 years old today, and was still doing TV at least a year or two ago. I remember seeing him on at least one sitcom as a semi-regular. And then if you watched Family Ties back in the 80s, you may or may not have known that the two actors who portrayed the parents, Michael Gross and Meredith Baxter, were actually both born on the exact same day, June 21st, 1947. So they both turned 76 years old today. Actor Chris Pratt is 43. And Prince William, the Prince of Wales, turns 41. That one makes me feel old, that it was 41 years ago, seeing him, you know, as a newborn with Charles and Princess Diana, taking him out of the hospital, and now 41 years old. Here was a debut album that was released this day by the Information Society in 1988. And this song is a clear example of how patience pays off, because Information Society waited 6 months to release their self-titled major label debut album until they could get permission to use various snippets from Star Trek, including Mr. Spock right there. It kind of helped make the song into a commercial hit. On this day in 1982, John Hinckley is found not guilty by reason of insanity for the attempted assassination of President Ronald Reagan. On this day in 1989, the Supreme Court ruled that burning the American flag is a form of political protest and it is protected by the First Amendment. On this day in 2011, Bon Iver, Eau Claire's own Justin Vernon, released the band's self-titled second album. Much acclaim, it should be noted, Aaron, on Bon Iver, whether you have those albums in your collection or not. I don't even know whether to ask youngins like you if you have albums anymore. You probably just stream songs. A song here and there.
I mean, mostly that's what I do, although I do stream albums usually rather than songs. But I have some vinyl records that I listen to now and then. This is not one of them, but...
So you do have a record player.
Yes, I do have vinyl records, and I have a record player. I actually use them.
Okay, very nice. All right, so there's our little music break and history lesson. We mentioned that there is a new app for civic media, and this text message through the app came from Lynn in Oconomowoc about state fair food. And forgive me, Lynn, because I haven't lived down there for just about 30 years, and so I'm going to perhaps botch the pronunciations of Millie's Mild Italian Sausage with grilled green peppers, Scortino's sesame bun with a cold beer. And Lynn notes that she eats her way from west to east at State Fair Park, which I think is a perfect strategy to take on. When I, being from this side of the state, I'm more often going to the Minnesota State Fair, and it is higgledy-piggledy or scattershot, however you want to describe the way I get all across the fairgrounds. But I do have those things I have to eat. I have to have fresh corn on the cob. I have to have the mini donuts. But most importantly, when at the state fair, I have to have for breakfast, because I get there about 7:30 in the morning, I have to have a foot-long hot dog with extra onions.
For breakfast?
I don't. For breakfast. Don't ask me. It's one of those things you start when you're like 12 years old because you can. You know, your mom or your grandma's bringing you to the state fair, and it's open and you're there. It's like this special treat, and somehow it has just stuck around ever since.
I respect that.
The foot-long hot dog for breakfast, you know? Hey, we all have to have our little quirks when eating favorite state fair foods. And another reminder, you can send us your favorite state fair foods either by text message through the new Civic Media app, which you can get on all the usual app distribution places. You can also email us, radio@upnorthnewswi.com, and you can put something on the live video feed over at the Up North News Facebook page or the Civic Media Facebook page or the page for Bull Falls Radio. We won't have a lot of time to talk about the ProPublica report that came out overnight, and it's all about Justice Samuel Alito, who is arguably the head of the far-right contingent of justices, and how it was discovered that he had taken a luxury fishing vacation with a Republican billionaire who later had cases before the court, and Alito did not recuse himself. Alito clearly knew the report was coming. No doubt ProPublica sent him, you know, tried to get messages and probably sent the questions to him saying, hey, we're doing this story. Would you like to answer these questions before the story runs? Rather than actually talking to the reporters and making sure that the story, you know, has his point of view in it, Alito did what one might expect increasingly from right-wing politicians, and that is to simply just bash the media rather than taking part in the reporting of the story. Alito wrote a prebuttal that was published in the Wall Street Journal. Now, again, keep in mind, this was before the ProPublica article came out. It's almost as if Alito knows a thing or two about the value of leaking information ahead of time. I don't know, like maybe the Dobbs decision weeks beforehand, but I don't want to get sidetracked here. Regardless, the story, which I read early this morning and would recommend to you as well, you'll find it at ProPublica.org, is all about the way that Alito accepted this fishing trip from this billionaire, didn't disclose it. It almost certainly is, you know, goes against ethics for almost any other federal government employee, almost any other government employee, period. But we count on U.S. Supreme Court justices to police themselves. And the article goes on to talk about the ways that Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia before him accepted trips and did not disclose them. In Alito's case, with somebody who then did have business before the court, some very big business. It's a case about how this billionaire bought up all kinds of debt from Argentina and was essentially going at war with the government. And he did get a favorable ruling from Alito and the other justices on the court. So again, very recommended reading to make your own decision on the presidential candidates you should be supporting who nominate the Supreme Court justices for life. State Representative Jody Emerson coming up after the break. You're up north.